From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, arms negotiator Paul Nitzer remembers his now-celebrated walk in the woods, and he describes some of the dirty tricks used against him in early talks with the Soviets. Also, John Malpeet and Kevin Williams tell us about bringing homeless people to the stage with the performance group known as the LAPD, the Los Angeles Poverty Department. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Beethoven sonatas performed by Irish pianist John O'Connor. And critic Owen Gleiberman looks at the 1964 movie Bedtime Story, starring David Niven and Marlon Brando. It's now out on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. The first increase in the hourly minimum wage since 1981 passed the House today by a lopsided vote of 382 to 37. The compromise measure adds 90 cents to the current $3.35 rate, raising the minimum wage to $4.25 an hour by April 1991. It includes a provision for a sub-minimum wage for inexperienced workers aged 16 to 19, allowing employers to pay them at 85% of the new minimum for their first 3 months on the job. A pro-Iranian Muslim group threatened today to kill Americans if the U.S. government implements a newly approved law to seize people wanted by the United States in foreign countries. The threat came in a handwritten statement sent to an international news agency in Muslim West Beirut. It also sent a Polaroid photograph of U.S. hostage Edward Austin Tracy, a book salesman seized in October of 1986. Pan Am World Airways has subpoenaed documents from six government agencies, including the CIA and FBI, to learn if they received advance warning from Israel's Secret Service about a bomb on board Pan Am Flight 103. A bomb explosion brought the plane down over Lockerbie, Scotland, 11 months ago, killing 259 people on board and 11 on the ground. Court papers filed in federal district court in New York show the airline also wants to prove that West Germany's criminal police warned U.S. officials about suspicious activities in the baggage area 90 minutes before the flight left Frankfurt for London. Bert Ammerman is president of the group Victims of Pan Am Flight 103, which is suing the airline. Ammerman sees nothing wrong with Pan Am's effort to learn if government agencies are to blame for the terrorist attack on the plane.
Our organization has dealt strictly with the truth. And if the truth is that our government was warned a day and a half before December 21st by Mossad, we want to know that, because that is far more important than any financial settlement, because then our government was involved indirectly or directly with the terrorists.
Ammerman's brother was one of those killed on Pan Am 103. Another Navy accident today as a fire on board the supply ship Monongahela injured 9 sailors early today. A spokesman for the Atlantic Fleet in Norfolk, Virginia, the ship's home base, says the accident occurred as the Monongahela sailed between Spain and the Azores. Virginia Republican Senator John Warner disagrees with those calling for a congressional investigation of a rash of Navy accidents.
Now, this unusual string of accidents is not, in the judgment of the Chief of Naval Operations of the Secretary, due to any lack of funds or any lack of what we call op-tempo training. It's just an extraordinary grouping of unrelated accidents.
Warner is formally served as Secretary of the Navy. On Wall Street, near the close, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down nearly 3 points at 2642.21 in moderate trading of 148 million shares. This is NPR News. Deplorable, that's what Washington is calling Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega's decision to end a unilateral ceasefire with Contra rebels. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the action is an affront to the hemisphere. But on Capitol Hill, New York Democratic Congressman Stephen Solars urged the administration not to respond by renewing U.S. military aid to the Contras. Meanwhile, the Bush administration says it's evaluating its relationship with the Managua government. In a broadcast speech announcing his decision today, Ortega accused President Bush of promoting criminal terrorism in Nicaragua and said the U.S. Congress would be responsible if escalating warfare interferes with February presidential elections. Testimony at government hearings on the crash of United Flight 232 indicates the flaw that might have caused the accident was detectable in advance. From Sioux City, Iowa, Doug Johnson of member station KWIT reports.
Testimony from the senior metallurgist for the National Transportation Safety Board indicated that a flaw apparently did exist in the fan disc of engine number 2 prior to the explosion that led to the crash in Sioux City. Testing was done to show that this flaw was different from overstressed fractures or those that occurred when the engine was destroyed. A design engineer for GE, Chris Glynn, was asked if the fracture was detectable in advance. He said he felt comfortable that it could have been found with ultrasonic testing. Robert Doughty from United Airlines said that they did all of the required fluoroscopic testing and assumed that the manufacturers had performed the more involved ultrasonic tests. Safety Board spokesmen are not yet ready to say that the flawed disc is the cause of the accident. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Johnson in Sioux City, Iowa.
The White House and the Kremlin have released nearly identical statements confirming that next month's Seaboard Summit between President Bush and Soviet leader Gorbachev will be held off Malta. The two sides continue to stress the informal nature of the meeting set for December 2nd and 3rd on board U.S. and Soviet ships. I'm Sharon Green in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Paul Nitze once said, "I've advised every president since Roosevelt, and all to some extent have sought and taken that advice." Nitze is generally acknowledged as one of the masters of arms negotiations. Perhaps the greatest example of his creativity was his 1982 Walk in the Woods, when Nitze and his Soviet counterpart broke away from the stalemated official arms talks for a secret meeting to discuss possible compromises. Nitze's role in arms diplomacy dates back to the end of World War II, when he was on the U.S. team that assessed the damage in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He advised President Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he was a key negotiator in the SALT I Treaty, the INF talks, and the START talks. In 1976, he was a founder of the Committee on the Present Danger, whose goal was to warn Americans that there was a growing Soviet threat. At the age of 82, Nitze has written his autobiography. It's called From Hiroshima to Glasnost, at the Center of Decision. I asked Paul Nitze how his negotiating team would prepare before going into arms talks with the Soviets.
In a negotiation, it is important to try to judge what the other side is going to do and how they're going to view things. So that I, in the beginning of the negotiations with the Soviets in 69, when we had our first talks directly on bilateral talks with the Soviets, before those talks began, I created a red team, a team that assumed themselves to be the Soviets, entering into the negotiations and thinking the way the Soviets think and talking out amongst themselves how they would plan their strategy for the negotiations and how they would react to the various moves that the Americans might take. The upshot was a very good team was created, and they quite correctly foresaw what the Soviets would in fact do during the first negotiating sessions between us, so that this was a very valuable tool.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've said in some negotiations that the Soviets would try to ply the Americans with food and drink in the hopes of getting them to reveal more. How do you know they weren't just being gracious hosts?
Because it became quite evident that that wasn't what they were being. They were trying to drink us under the table, seduce us with attractive women, do all kinds of quite normal things if somebody's using all the dirty tricks in order to come out ahead in a negotiation.
Since they were trying to drink you under the table, did you try to, while they were drinking a lot, get them to reveal things?
Well, that wasn't our style. Our style was just, let's not drink ourselves under the table. Let's not do what they're proposing. So finally, they agreed with that, and we finally gave up altogether. Neither side was really doing much of any drinking. We'd have a friendly sip of one kind or another, but they finally gave up this technique of trying to drink us under the table.
And what period was that technique used?
Well, that was way back at the beginning of the negotiations, 69, 70, 71.
What other dirty tricks did you feel that the Soviets used over the years?
Well, they had very good spy apparatus, you know, to listen in on our conversations. They had very sensitive detectors. They had us surrounded with listening devices. They even had devices which would pick up the vibrations of our voices on the window panes. They had hidden, you know, microphones here, there, and the other place. So it was very difficult to avoid their hearing our conversations.
So if you wanted to have a conversation with someone else from the U.S. negotiating team, you'd have to walk outside?
No, what we would do is to go into what was called a bubble. And a bubble is a plastic room with electric wires going through the plastic, which make it impossible for anybody from the outside to get the vibrations of what's going on inside. So those rooms are really wholly impervious to being, for the Soviets to hear what is going on inside this plastic bubble. And that's where you would do all your talking, was in such a bubble.
In the dirty tricks category, in your memoir, you also mentioned the divide and conquer strategy that the Soviets would sometimes use against the Americans. How would that work?
Well, Mr. Semyonov, who was head of the delegation, would sit next to me at dinner and would describe what a marvelous person I was and how he admired Jim Forrestal, who had been my senior partner in Dillon Reed & Company. And then he would hint that he really was somewhat disappointed with Gerard Smith, the head of our delegation. And then he would talk to Gerard and say what a marvelous person Gerard was. And he appreciated his devotion to learning how to speak Russian, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And really what a cold and dreadful fish I was. That sort of thing.
Well, how did you find out that this was happening? Did you confer with each other?
Yes, Gerard would tell me, and I would tell Gerard what Semyonov was up to. So it didn't really produce much in the way of results, but I'm just illustrating a technique.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever confront him with it? Or is that absurd?
Well, I did indirectly, yes.
What did you say?
Well, I was defending Gerard, because I thought very highly of Gerard. So that I don't think he really got very far with this, but he certainly was trying it out for size.
My guest is the United States preeminent arms negotiator, Paul Nitze, and he's written a memoir called From Hiroshima to Glasnost. Have you trusted the Soviets over the years that you've negotiated with them? And is it possible to negotiate without trust?
It is possible to negotiate. You take positions and they take their positions. And one takes, one just sees what eventually turns out. One doesn't really have to trust them. One sees whether, if one gets to an agreement, that one can verify whether it's being adhered to or whether it is not. But I think Mr. Reagan, for instance, used to say, negotiate, but verify. I think that was the phrase he used.
And you'd concur?
I concur in that, yes.
I want to ask you about the walk in the woods of 1982 when you went off for a private walk outside with your Soviet counterpart, Yuli Kvitsinsky. Why was it necessary for the two of you to break off from the official negotiations and talk outside of that?
We had kept a record of everything that either they had said or we had said on the various issues which had arisen during the talks up to that time. So we had this issues book, which had in it about 5 important issues and some 30 or more, 35 lesser important issues. And we thoroughly knew what their position was, every word that they'd said on each one of those issues, and they knew what our position was. So there was complete understanding between the two sides as to what was dividing us. The question at issue was, how do you bring the two sides together? There, if one concedes on an important issue to their position, they will just take that concession and they won't give you anything for it. And that had been our experience for a long period of time. I didn't see how we were going to make any prompt progress without matching off a whole series of concessions on their side with a whole series of concessions on our side to arrive at a package deal in which their concessions would more or less balance ours. It seemed to me that the best way to do that was to have a side negotiation in which Kvitsinsky and I would come up with a package. But in order to come up with such a package that would be balanced, and we would then submit it to our governments to see whether they thought it was balanced, in order to do that, you have to conduct a different kind of a negotiation than was being conducted on the official level where we both were negotiating under instructions from our two governments. Kvitsinsky told me it was important that we make progress promptly because the Soviets were having a big meeting in which they were eventually going to come up with a revision of their position, which would be probably the only one. During Brezhnev's health, his lifetime during his health. And if we were going to get anything done, we had to get it done promptly, was his view. And I took seriously what he told me. So I suggested to him that why don't the two of us go off someplace and see whether the two of us can arrive at a package of concessions by the two sides. And at first, Kwitsinski was leery of it, but then he decided, well, let's try it.
How did you know Kwitsinski's character? Did you feel that you could trust him in asking him to participate in this unofficial negotiation?
Well, my view is to take on face value what the other side tells you until you know, have good evidence that it's wrong and that it is fraudulent. And with respect to Kwitsinski, I thought I'd finally developed a certain skill in knowing where he was talking, you know, really where you could believe in it, and where he was talking under instructions, where it was just a facade. So that I had some, you have to take a chance, you know, you have to make up your own mind whether it is for real or whether it isn't. But we finally did get to an agreed piece of paper, but he wasn't at all sure that he could persuade his seniors in Moscow to agree to that. And he said that he didn't want me to do anything until I heard further from him, that he'd talked to his superiors and that our ideas had fallen on fertile ground. And if so, he would let me know through a designated man in the Soviet embassy. But he never did let me know through the embassy. And 7 weeks went by before the negotiations resumed, at which time he told me that right away when he'd gotten back to Moscow, it had been made clear that the internal Soviet discussions had already taken place that he'd warned me were going to take place, and that they had decided quite vigorously against the ideas we had developed in our talks. But he'd also been instructed not to let me know anything. So that by the time 3 or 4 weeks had passed without hearing anything from the Soviet embassy, I was quite convinced that he hadn't had any fortune in discussing this with his superiors. And so I rather abandoned any hope that our piece of paper was really going to float. And then later I ran into real objection on our side. So it never came to pass. But if it had come to pass, I still believe it would have been a very good deal for us and a very good deal for the Soviets, and a lot of pain and agony would have been avoided if that had been approved by both sides.
Well, I want to talk with you more, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Paul Nitze. He's America's preeminent arms negotiator and has been a key figure in shaping U.S. foreign policy for more than 45 years. He's written a new memoir. It's called From Hiroshima to Glasnost. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Paul Nitze is my guest. When you were organizing this walk in the woods with your Soviet counterpart, were you afraid that someone else from the United States would find out that you were doing it? Were you very secretive while you were working out the details of where you'd meet and how you were going to get there?
I was secretive only about one thing, and that was after the walk in the woods, I was secretive about the degree to which we'd come to agreement on a common piece of paper. I told everybody on my team exactly what I'd come in with in the way of negotiation, in the way of negotiating positions. But I didn't tell them the degree of success that I'd had. I wanted to keep that secret until I could get back to Washington and describe it first to the president.
How were you reprimanded by the United States?
I wasn't really reprimanded, no.
You weren't?
No.
Were there a few people within the administration who thought that it was a real bad move for you to have held these unofficial negotiations?
Oh, there were, but I wasn't reprimanded by the President or the Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
No, they understood perfectly well what I was trying to do. But this is true of almost any important negotiation. Mr. Schultz, for instance, you know, is an old negotiator, and he thoroughly recognized that in an important negotiation where you finally got into a mutual standoff where you're not making any progress, it is necessary to find some device and to get around the formalities of the negotiation and see whether someone can't come up through a different channel, some potential solution which will get the negotiations going again.
Even though your walk in the woods, even though the agreements that you reach in the walk in the woods never came to pass, do you feel that the walk itself created a valuable precedent for future arms negotiations?
Not really, but I'm sure the fact that we tried to, that somebody on behalf of the United States tried to find a solution to that problem within the time period when it really would have been helpful if we had done so, this was very helpful to us later in our relations with the Europeans, particularly the Germans.
Mm-hmm. Paul Nitze is my guest. You write in your memoir From Hiroshima to Glasnost a little bit about some of the presidents who you've worked with. One of the things you say about Richard Nixon is that he was terribly secretive, so secretive that he'd even use Soviet translators so that the American negotiators wouldn't have access to what he was saying, or something like that. Maybe you can explain a little
better. No, I did. He said exactly that. The problem with Mr. Nixon was that he didn't want to keep things secret from the Russians, because after all, they were on the other side of the table in his discussions with him. He wanted to keep these things secret from the Americans, because he was really deceiving the Americans as to what he was doing. He was building up his negotiations with the Soviets as being the great justification for his continuing to be president, when many of the Americans, in particular people in the Congress, thought he should be impeached. And his defense against impeachment really was, I'm so important to the United States in my relations with the Soviets that you shouldn't impeach me, because I'm the one person who can continue to negotiate in a worthwhile way with the Soviets. So this was his defense against impeachment. So it's quite obvious that he didn't want the Americans to know too much of what was really going on in the negotiations.
So did he keep a lot of information from you?
He did indeed. From all of us negotiators.
And how did you confront him on that?
Well, I finally found out from my Soviet counterparts about the negotiations he was having with them at a higher level. Because on the Soviet side, they kept their negotiators better informed as to what was going on at higher levels than did Nixon keep us, Nixon Henry Kissinger.
So when is the right time to go public about something like this?
Oh, that's a tricky and difficult question to answer. We did tell the Congress, particularly the Senate, about some of these instances in which we'd been kept in the dark, and I believe the Senate had been misled. But that occurred in testimony before the Senate, you know, when you're under oath to speak correctly and honestly. And those hearings were in turn classified, so they did not immediately leak to the press.
Let's talk about President Reagan for a moment. Now, Strobe Talbot, who wrote a biography of you, it's actually focusing on your work in some specific arms negotiations. He refers to what he calls as President Reagan's stunning ignorance about the nuclear weapons over which he had control. When Reagan was president, did you feel that way about him? Did you feel that he was one of the least knowledgeable of American presidents of how nuclear arms worked and what they really meant?
It's impossible for a president to be fully informed on the details of all the issues that he has to deal with. Basically, he has to rely upon his principal advisors for that. I did think that Mr. Reagan was perhaps less knowledgeable about the details of these nuclear weapons than some of the other presidents have been. But that I don't find necessarily something to condemn. He would sometimes tend to make an error in those details, but Shultz would correct him on them, and so we never really got into any trouble on it.
You write in your memoir that you were quite surprised when President Reagan made his first Star Wars address. Did you not know that he was going to recommend the development and the funding of SDI?
I did not know that, no. And not only did I know nothing about it, but even Mr. Weinberger, you know, the Secretary of Defense, he knew nothing about it. And I don't think Mr. Shultz knew anything about it. So this was something that the president did with Bud McFarland and the president's scientific advisor and one or two others. But this was not really discussed with anybody at a high level in the U.S. government.
If he had discussed it with you before going public about it, what would you have said to him?
I would have said that there's no solid evidence either that such a system can be developed or that it can't. There's an awful lot of work that has to be done before one can really have a firm judgment as to whether it can meet the criteria that it should be attained before you could possibly deploy, be justified in deploying such a system.
So your strategy became to basically use Star Wars as a bargaining chip in negotiations with the Soviets.
It's after having studied carefully all the results of the scientific experiments that had been made to date. I didn't really change that my basic view that it hadn't been proven whether or not this could be done. Either way, it wasn't clear that it couldn't be done. It wasn't clear that you could do it. But I was clear on one thing, and that is you couldn't possibly do it within 10 years in any meaningful way. So that it seemed to me to be perfectly proper to agree to postpone any deployment of such a system for at least 10 years and see whether you could get something worthwhile from the Soviets for such a postponement.
I think it's fair to say that your negotiating strategy over the years has been based on the belief that the Soviets really wanted nuclear superiority, not parity. And I'm wondering if you think that Glasnost has changed that in any fundamental way.
Certainly, Mr. Gorbachev says so, but I still don't believe it's for real, necessarily. So that I still think it's up to us to maintain a capability which would be sufficient to deter anybody who might wish to use those, you know, 40,000 or more big nuclear weapons that exist on Soviet territory today, use them in a way antagonistic to the rest of the world.
Well, I regret that we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be interrogated by you.
Paul Nitz's new memoir, From Hiroshima to Glasnost, is published by Grove Weidenfeld. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with actor and director Alan Arkin. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. John Malpete is a former New York performance artist who now runs a theater company of homeless people in Los Angeles. Malpete has been the victim of some scams along the way, but the theater group has changed the lives of many of its homeless participants. Coming up, we meet John Malpete and his formerly homeless assistant director, Kevin Williams. Also, we review a new recording of Beethoven piano sonatas as interpreted by Irish pianist John O'Connor. And remember last year's movie Dirty Rotten Scoundrels about a pair of womanizing con artists? It was a remake of the 1964 movie Bedtime Story, starring David Niven and Marlon Brando. Bedtime Story is now out on home video, and Owen Gleiberman has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. A major earthquake registering over 7 on the Richter scale has struck off Japan's Honshu Island. Officials say 3 coastal villages were ordered evacuated for fear of tidal waves. There are no immediate reports of casualties or damage from the quake, which was centered about 60 miles off the coast and at a depth of 20 miles. That's off Japan's Honshu Island. The Nicaraguan rebel leadership in Honduras has ordered its troops inside Nicaragua to avoid combat with the Sandinistas. Contra military leader Enrique Bermudez also appealed to Central American presidents to intercede with Managua in an attempt to prevent renewed fighting. It's part of the storm of reaction to Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega's decision to end a 19-month unilateral ceasefire with the Contras. David Adams reports from Managua on Ortega's long-awaited announcement.
Ortega said Nicaragua had the right to defend itself against U.S. aggression. He said that the U.S. seemed to think Nicaragua is just another state of the U.S., another star in the U.S. flag. It was a passionate speech in which he said Nicaragua had turned its cheek too many times to provocations from the Contra rebels. We don't want a ceasefire, he said. We want an end to the war. Ortega said that in recent weeks, large numbers of Contras had been infiltrating across the border and that there were now 6,000 rebels in Nicaragua. He said the Contras were determined to sabotage any effort to be demobilized and that they were also seeking to undermine the Nicaraguan elections scheduled for next February. He said that was because they knew the Sandinista front would win. For National Public Radio, this is David Adams in Managua.
In Washington, the White House labeled Ortega's action deplorable and accused him of trying to scuttle those February elections. A compromise minimum wage hike has received overwhelming House approval. The lawmakers voted 382-37 in favor of raising the hourly minimum wage from the current $3.35 to $4.25 an hour by April 1991. Senate leaders have promised to vote on the compromise soon so that President Bush would be able to sign it before Thanksgiving. The pro-Iranian Revolutionary Justice Organization in Lebanon has threatened to kill Americans if the U.S. government implements a newly approved law to seize people wanted by the United States in foreign countries. Earlier today, the Iranian parliament passed a law allowing its agents to track down Americans anywhere in the world and bring them to trial in Tehran if they are deemed to have harmed Iranian interests. Namibian guerrilla leaders are challenging South African Foreign Minister Pik Botha's remarks today. He told a news conference that South African troops have been put on alert because of reports that Namibian guerrillas recently crossed into Namibia from Angola. Stock prices were fractionally higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 0.41 to close at 2645.49. Advances led declines about 3-2 on volume of 155 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Aside from the stereotypical Irish tenor, Ireland has produced few musicians who've achieved international recognition. But classical music critic Lord Schwartz has a review of the latest CD in a series of Beethoven sonatas played by the Irish pianist John O'Connor. And Lloyd says these recordings place O'Connor among the major living pianists.
Thank you. Beethoven's 32 piano sonatas may still be the most universally accepted standard for judging a pianist, the way Hamlet may be the greatest test for an actor. In 1986, the Telarc label began a Beethoven sonata series with the young Irish pianist John O'Connor. This year, Telarc released the third disc in the series. The first two included some of Beethoven's best-known sonatas, the Moonlight, the Appassionata, the Pathetique, the Waldstein. The most familiar sonata on this recent disc is probably the Pastoral. It's the one that came right after the Moonlight. O'Connor's performance is ideal. He plays with an unusual degree of lyrical elegance. He has a delicate touch that makes the textures seem translucent and luminous. This kind of playing risks a certain preciousness. Oh, isn't this passage just too exquisite? Some pianists play as if they had 10 pinkies. But O'Connor has no such affectation. Part of his elegance is the honesty and directness of his phrasing. He's aristocratic in the very best sense of the word. He's got a backbone. Here's the opening of the fourth movement of the Pastoral, the movement that gives the sonata its nickname. Imagine an Arcadian shepherd playing the pipes for his favorite shepherdess, or sheep. Three sonatas on this disc come from that odd transitional stage between Beethoven's so-called early and middle periods, just after the turn of the 19th century. Beethoven was in his early 30s. He just finished his first symphony. These are not among his most profound or passionate works, but they show fascinating developments in his style and techniques, surprising key relationships, unexpected formal decisions. Yet they also look back to the thematic simplicity of his earlier style. One modern critic considered the Opus 31 No. 1 sonata Beethoven's worst, but there's a delightful playfulness in its experimentation with sound and texture. Maybe that's why some people don't like it. The third sonata on this disc is Opus 31 No. 3, The Hunt. Opus 31 No. 2, The Tempest, was included on the second disc in O'Connor's series. I especially love the tenderly conversational qualities of the opening theme. Later in the movement, a little argument begins to erupt. Thank you. But the tenderness is soon restored, and the movement ends as affectionately as it began. O'Connor beautifully captures Beethoven's subtly shifting moods. Along with his forthrightness, O'Connor is also good with ambiguities, which makes me look forward all the more eagerly to his treatment of Beethoven's later, deeper, and even more ambiguous works.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new Telarc recording of Beethoven piano sonatas performed by John O'Connor. This is Fresh Air. The LAPD, or the Los Angeles Poverty Department, is a theater group based in LA's Skid Row. Most of its performers are homeless or live in Skid Row hotels. It was founded in 1985 by John Malpied, a former New York performance artist who was bored with the insularity of the New York art scene and was looking for something more meaningful. He moved to Los Angeles and became a legal advocate for the homeless, and then combined his advocacy work with theater. The LAPD performs sketches and improvs that reflect life on the margins of society. The group occasionally travels to other cities to take up residencies. Once there, they recruit local players from the city shelters, welfare offices, and streets. Material is developed around the lives and experiences of the newcomers. The LAPD has been in Philadelphia for the past 2 weeks and will perform this Friday at the end of their stay. I spoke with Malpied and the group's assistant director, Kevin Williams, who was formerly homeless. I asked Malpied to give us a sense of how the shows are created.
When we first started the group, everyone, because most of the people down there have had very little attention given them, you know, starting in childhood, really, you know.
Or negative attention.
Yeah, or negative attention, like they were the brunt, the family goat or whatever. You know, everyone was like dying for attention. So when the group first started, everyone brought in their own manuscript and stood up and read it at the same time, you know. And everyone wanted to be the star, and everyone wanted their show to be done. You know, well, I really wasn't interested in this in the first place, you know. And so because it was really an impossible situation, we started working without scripts, and so that everybody could contribute, but no one would have authorship. And it also maintains the chaos and the jarringness of life on Skid Row. So it turns out to be a really appropriate style for the group.
Give us a really short capsule description of one of the plays you've recently done.
Jupiter 35 is about one of the group's members, Leroy Mills, who was tossed from a sixth-floor window of a Los Angeles building and survived, and the group's participation in his reemergence into society.
He was robbed and thrown from a sixth-floor window, which is a common way of dealing with people on Skid Row, because it's cheap, you don't have to buy bullets or anything like that, and of course it's a suicide, you know. So, but anyway, he survived, and his face is completely restructured, and it's about his recuperation, and about the events that led up to his being tossed out the window,
yeah.
And then also about the group's relationship to him, because some of us played ourselves visiting him in the hospital and things like that.
You must get quite a mix of people coming down to, like, first performances or auditions or whatever they are in the beginning. And I'd imagine that some of the people are people who are really, like, interested in the chance to perform, people who are homeless because they're down on their luck or because they're a victim of unemployment or whatever. But I bet you also get a lot of people who are, hardened criminals, or who are, you know, kind of psychopathic and you know, kind of nuts. I'm sure some people come down hoping that they can rip you off or something while they're there.
Yeah. Well, we teach him a lesson by in one of our shows, I have a big monologue where I admit that yes, I am the biggest chump in America. And this is a and that yes, I have bought more crack cocaine than anyone in America without knowing it. You understand?
Without having
only,
any.
You know, only yeah. only because I thought I was giving people money for a sandwich and all this other stuff. You know, so at one point, because when we were in San Francisco a couple of years, what you're describing happened. And we went from having about 15 people the first day until we had one person actually in the show, and everyone else was running scams. And so the way we took out our vengeance is by including all this in the show. And so I have this big monologue about that.
Well, what did you do at the time, though, when you realized you were being scammed? Could you get rid of the people?
Well, usually they disappear. Around. After the scam, they usually disappear.
Yeah.
When they think they've played their string out as far as possible.
Or if we let them know that we're onto it. Uh-huh. You know, yeah.
Right. But the one thing, when I started the group, it seemed to be really important that it be a very open door policy. Because what I'd seen on Skid Row, and of course I was full of naivete at the time, was that a lot of the people who are the most in need of services aren't going to get them because it's always you can have a bed if you behave yourself. You can have a meal if you behave yourself. Well, these people, they aren't going to act right. Therefore, the people that aren't going to act right are going to be out on the street. So I was interested in including those people as much as possible and seeing what made them tick and having them be part of the group. But, and we do have a lot of people, we've had a lot of people with mental problems in the group, and we still do. I mean, probably half of the people in the group are now getting SSI, which is the federal benefit for people who can't work for mental or physical reasons. And in our cases, people in our group, it's for mental disabilities for the most part. But they've been, a lot of them have been enormous contributors to the group and have done really, really, really great work. So, having problems isn't a criteria for getting booted, nor is having talent a criteria for being included. I mean, yeah.
I was watching you work with some people from Philadelphia yesterday, and these were people who, I think there were like three homeless people from Philadelphia who'd come down to work with you during the time I was there. One of them was sleeping across three chairs in the theater part. And Kevin, what you did was to wake him up, stick him with a pin.
Well, yeah, I did. Didn't actually stick him. I threatened to. I let him see I had it.
What kind of response were you looking for?
Guess what, Junior? It doesn't play here. There's a social agencies. the first day we were here and we did our workshop and we were doing the welfare thing, we came to this point in the middle of two people's improv where the improv broke apart and the entire room joined in because everyone felt like, if you go into a welfare place, you go into a social agency, and if you tell them the truth, you won't get any help. But if you lie, and if you're just willing to sit around and bum around, you get, the services, whatever services you need or want, or they'll give you. And in our group, it's like, no, it doesn't, we don't want you to lie to us and go to sleep and just sit around. We want involvement and get in your face involvement, or get out.
You've, I'm sure, been to several Skid Rows and gang areas and cities across the country because, first of all, because you've traveled, and second of all, because you've traveled with the group and you go there to recruit people to perform with you. Are you struck more by the similarities or differences from city to city?
I'm beginning to be able to see some differences. The most interesting difference that I'm feeling now is the guys, the attitude of the guys we're working with. Like when we were in San Francisco, I was saying earlier, we had run into a lot of scams up in San Francisco. And San Francisco is a city, that is super socially conscious. And they have like program after program after program after program for homeless people and for all kinds of people. It's just a very involved community. But when we were there, when this happened 2 years ago, these guys who were like really, they were in shelters. They were getting three squares at Glide Memorial Church and all this.
Vultures.
But they were still, they had this attitude like, you know, who can we scam for nothing?
What can now, the guys, do for me?
The guys we're working with here, most of them are sleeping on the street because they don't like the city shelter system, which is, you know, really pretty bad and dangerous and ugly and so forth. They're sleeping on the street, and they're not really connected to anything or up until they got involved with us. But yet they were looking, you know, they really... No one's tried to hit any of us up for money or run any sort of scams on us whatsoever. They're interested in just
the work.
Doing this because they feel that it's going to help them, that it's fun to be with us, you know, that it's better than being out on the street, and that through us they're getting to make other connections with people who are going to be here and be able to keep them plugged in the future.
John, where do you live now?
I live in Echo Park, which is it's a Latino neighborhood, and it's about 10 minutes by car northwest of the Skid Row area. So it's, you know, I don't have, unlike when I was living in New York, East Village, which is my training ground, I guess, for being on Skid Row, when I go home, I don't have to worry. I can walk out the door I don't have to worry about terrible things happening to me. But when I'm downtown, I think about it.
Do you own much or have much money? And I was wondering if it must be hard to make a lot of money in the line of work that you're in. But beyond that, I was wondering if you'd feel too kind of self-conscious about it to have much, even if you did.
Well, yeah, you get sucked into the whole guilt thing. I mean, I don't have a lot of money. You know, I don't have to worry about that. But still, if you have a place to stay, then, you know, then everyone I work with thinks I'm, you know, John D. Rockefeller instead of John D. Malpied, you know. So, you know, from their point of view, they think I must have all sorts of money, you know. So it is a difficult situation, and it's difficult to say no to people, you know, when the need is there, but the need is overwhelming, you know, and even John D. Rockefeller could not solve all the problems that are out there, you know, nor is just throwing money at it the way to solve it, you know. But I've learned through doing too much, you know, for having too many people living at my house, for giving away too much money that was stupidly given away, stuff like that, that I have to set real limits, you know, on myself, or otherwise, you know, I'm going to go nuts, you know, and jump out the window. And I only live on the first floor, you know, so that's a big problem.
Well, I thank you both very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
John Malpied, Kevin Williams, and the LAPD will perform this Friday at the Painted Bride Art Center in Philadelphia. The group returns to Los Angeles, then plans to take up a 6-week residency in Chicago this spring. This is Fresh Air. Let's check in with Noah Adams and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Among other stories tonight, Nicaragua's President Daniel Ortega has decided to end the ceasefire against the Contras fighting for control of Nicaragua. NPR's David Malpas reviews the U.S. Navy's problematic week so far. They've had several shipboard accidents. Bob Mondello reviews a new movie called Apartment Zero. It's a film from England. It's playing in this country to enthusiastic film festival crowds. And I'll have a conversation with Bud Freeman, a jazz musician from Chicago. He's 83 years old now, a tenor saxophone player for many, many years, and he has a brand new book called Crazology.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The home video version of last year's movie Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, starring Michael Caine and Steve Martin, has been in stores for a few months. That film was a remake of a movie called Bedtime Story. Now that's available on video, too. Critic Owen Gleiberman has a review.
Remember when con artists were romantic heroes? Not anymore. It's become tricky to turn fraud and corruption into something civilized and charming. There's too much of it in the headlines. But back in 1964... you could still make a breezy farce out of two crackerjack swindlers conning their way to paradise. Bedtime Story offers up the unlikely comic chemistry of David Niven and Marlon Brando. Niven has the role that later went to Michael Caine. He plays an elegant British rascal who lives in a chateau on the French Riviera and specializes in parting rich women from their jewelry. His scam is pretending to be an expatriate prince desperate for money to feed his starving kingdom. The female travelers he meets aren't just willing to bequeath their diamonds. They're downright eager.
Please, Your Highness, allow me to make this little contribution to your great cause.
Even though these emeralds would mean freedom for many of my people, I cannot accept them.
But I beg you, think what these can buy.
No, madame.
The lives of men, women, and tiny children.
The men and women of my country would rather die than have their prince accept charity. But for the tiny children, I am eternally in your debt.
Enter Brando in the Steve Martin role. He plays a swaggering army colonel who's an ace huckster in his own right. This guy also preys exclusively on women. But he's less concerned with fleecing them for a buck than with seeing how many young blondes of every nationality he can con into the sack. He'll show up at the house of some voluptuous innocent and launch into an atrocious cornball speech about how his grandmother used to live there. It's not long before the ladies are swooning. When Brando meets up with Niven, he gives the older, cultivated gent a few pointers in the art of chivalry.
Remember this, it takes six men to carry a guy to his grave. It takes one woman to put him there.
I never thought of it that way.
Well, I can tell you the kind of guy that goes around opening doors for broads, holding their chairs, knocking yourself out, right?
I've been known to do that.
You know who started this whole schmear? An English guy called Raleigh.
Sir Walter Raleigh?
That's the goof.
Niven, who senses a rival, tries to chase Brando out of the Riviera. But the American upstart knows there's money and women to be made there, and he won't budge. To settle their territorial dispute, the two make a wager to see who can be the first to dupe American soap queen Shirley Jones out of $25,000. Bedtime Story's script is virtually identical to the one for Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. The difference is that while the remake had some laughs, its tone seemed off. It was long and clunky, too aggressively slapstick. Bedtime Story is lighter on its feet. It has some of the casually heartless spirit of the classic British Ealing comedies, like Kind Hearts and Coronets, even if it isn't finally in their class. The wild card here is Brando, who proves a surprisingly deft light comedian. His innate physicality doesn't muck things up here the way it did in Guys and Dolls. Instead, it becomes a source of comedy, especially when he confines his hulking frame to a wheelchair and makes shameless puppy dog pleas for Shirley Jones's sympathy. David Niven, as always, is debonair to the max and as fastidious as a butler. Bedtime Story is nothing more than a slick light farce that erupts occasionally into all-out hilarity. Its chief virtue is that, unlike the Michael Caine Steve Martin flick, it's not trying to knock you flat with laughter. It's content to be ticklish and to give its dirty rotten scoundrels an affectionate nod.
Owen Gleiberman is a Boston-based writer and critic. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air, research assistants from Seuss Bolin and Rich Banowitz. And we want to welcome the listeners of station WKSU in Kent, Ohio, which started broadcasting Fresh Air today. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet actor and director Alan Arkin. He has a new movie in the works, and he's just directed an episode of Public TV's comedy series, Trying Times. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new albums from Janet Jackson and Laurie Anderson. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.